I call upon Brother Brian to speak to the subject, Ye Are My Witnesses.
Isaiah 43 has twice in it, verse 10 and again in verse 12, the statement that Israel are God's witnesses. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant, whom I have chosen. And again in verse 12, I have declared and have saved and have showed where there was no strange God among you. Therefore, ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. And the wonder of this chapter, Isaiah chapter 43, is its tremendous statement of the intimacy of God with Israel, of the relationship that he has with this people of Israel. It's really an amazing chapter in that theme. And it's so strikingly different from that which we concluded with in chapter 42. For you remember in the last half of our class last week that with the introduction of the story of the blind man, we were able to see what the significance was of verses 18 to 21, where the servant of God was said to have ears but heard not, to have eyes but he saw not, seeing many things, verse 20, but thou observest not, opening the ears but he heareth not. This servant was blinder than the Gentiles that he thought to show the way. He was deafer than those to whom he thought he was ears. And so in verse 22 to 25, God's judgment was going to come upon him. This is a people robbed and spoiled. They are all of them snared in holes, and they are hid in prison houses. They state their own position confidently in contrast with the Gentiles. But if the Gentiles are in prison houses, chapter 42 verse 6, and in need of light, chapter 42 verse 7, then this Jewish nation, verse 22, are all of them snared in holes, hid in prison houses. And they're there for a prey, and none delivereth, for spoil, and none saith restore. And yet, despite the judgments of God that would come upon them, there didn't seem to be any will to learn the lesson. Who among you will give ear to this? Well, they didn't have ears to hear, as verse 20 had said. Who among you will give ear to this? Very few would be the answer. That statement is very similar, really, to the 53rd chapter, where the clear inference of the prophet Isaiah is that the gospel was not going to be received, unfortunately, by many in Israel. For in chapter 53, verse 1, having stated the summary facts, verses 12 to 15 in chapter 52, of Christ, it says, "Who hath received our report? And to whom is the arm of Yahweh revealed?" And the answer very clearly is an unfortunately small number. And that's also the sense of chapter 42 and verse 23. Who among you will give ear to this? Either listening to Isaiah now and accepting it, or later on when the judgment comes, responding in repentance to God. Who will hearken and hear for the time to come to learn a lesson from it? And the unfortunate answer, by implication, is not many. Who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers? Did not Yahweh, he against whom we have sinned? And you know, to this very day, that remains a conundrum in the nation of Israel. Despite everything that has happened to them, there is still no understanding among them as to why it has happened. I think I probably recorded at an earlier time an address that I heard on the radio. It was really a conference, and it was a conference of Jewish people held in Melbourne in January a couple of years ago. It was a most amazing conference, and various people were brought in to state why they thought the Holocaust. What a thing that happened in your lives or our ecclesial life. You'd have to have a reason for it, wouldn't you? Couldn't live without a reason for it. Well, here's the people of God that still lift themselves up above all others and are confident that their position is right, refuse Jesus as the Son of God. And yet they still have no answer to why that has happened. All said one, God doesn't promise a bed of roses. Another actually used the Bible and said, well, the book of Job shows that not all affliction is a bad thing in the end. But no one could put their answer on the circumstance. Surely, if one claims to be the people of God and tremendous reversals happen, then surely one has to see that God is involved in it. Who gave Jacob, therefore, for a spoil and Israel to the robbers? I did, says God. Did not I, Yahweh? He against whom we have sinned? For they would not walk in his ways, neither were they obedient unto his law. Therefore, he hath poured upon him the fury of his anger and the strength of battle. To this day, the tremendous reversals they have suffered have never been understood. It hath set him on fire round about, yet he knew not. And it burned him, yet he laid it not to heart. Now you would think that many people could say, well, that's the end of the story. And people do, don't they? AD 70, that was the cut-off point of God's special relationship with Israel. The Jehovah's Witnesses themselves, that in fact usurp the interpretation of the chapter. They say that in AD 70, that was the cut-off point. And the special favour that God had with that people ceased because they had rejected his son. Now can you see, therefore, the power of chapter 43? Chapter 43 is coming back like thunder. Chapter 43 is an exciting, repetitive statement of God's tremendous love for that people, of his unswerving determination. Despite the robbers, despite the thieves, whether they be their own people. You know, Jesus said, didn't he, that all that came before me were thieves and robbers. And he's speaking about the teachers of the nation. Or would they be the Romans, or the Babylonians after Isaiah's time, or the Assyrians? Whoever they were, God is saying, nevertheless, despite all that, chapter 43, but now thus saith Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by thy name, and thou art mine. He's already been introduced to us, our Heavenly Father, in this book, in chapter 40, as Creator. In chapter 40, for example, verse 12, he weighed the heavens and the earth in scales, as it were. He is indeed the Creator. In verse 26 of Isaiah 40, lift up your eyes on high, and behold who hath created these things. This is the heavens above with all their untold numbers, that bringeth out their host by number. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, and that he is strong in power, and not one faileth. So he's Creator, isn't he? Verse 28 again. Hast thou not known, hast thou not heard, that the everlasting God, Yahweh, the Creator of the ends of the earth, is Creator, all right, isn't he? He's Creator of all peoples. See chapter 42, verse 5. Thus saith Ael, Yahweh, he that created the heavens, stretched them out. But he's also Creator of Israel. This overwhelmingly wonderful God of limitless power and knowledge and plan, he also created Israel. But now thus saith Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not. So it's very beautiful, isn't it? Exceedingly beautiful. There are two expressions there. One is the word created, the Hebrew word bara, which is the usual word translated created. And then we have the word formed. In actual fact, the two words are very similar in their intent. If you look up Young's Concordance, at Bara, it says, to prepare or form or fashion or create, and the other one says to form or fashion or constitute. So, you know, you can, they're obviously used very much interchangeably. We're not to sort of look for some distinctive nuance in the second phrase that wasn't in the first. It's actually repeated, those statements, in verse 21 of chapter 43. This people, verse 21, have I formed for myself. I have formed for myself. This people I have formed for myself. What an amazing statement. Never said that about Australians, did he? Or Canadians, or Americans, or Russians. This people I have formed for myself. Again, in the 44th chapter and verse 2. Thus saith Yahweh that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant. So, very beautiful statements. No other people can state a passage in the Bible where it says that God did thus for them in that manner. Now that limitless, all-wise and wonderful God that did that and yet came back and made his people, that's a very similar concept to what you have in Psalm 95. Very, very similar. The wonder of it was often noted in the prophets and in the Psalms, that such a great and illustrious being should deign to consider the weakness of mankind. So Psalm 95 and verse 3. For Yahweh is a great God and a great King above all gods. Now watch this carefully. In his hand are the deep places of the earth. The strength of the hills is his also. The sea is his, and he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel down before Yahweh our Maker. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture. Isn't that beautiful? The wonder, the sheer wonder, that he who could plant the heavens and spread them out like a curtain, as he says in chapter 40, should actually have brought forth a particular people, is a remarkable thing indeed. There is therefore in this 43rd chapter, as it opens, a very wonderful contrast with the predicament, or the statement of predicament, in verses 22 to 25 of the previous chapter. It says, fear not. Fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. When did God call Israel by Israel's name? Well, the obvious answer to that is in Genesis chapter 32. It's true that he called them by their name. He gave Israel its name. Genesis chapter 32. You notice that he speaks about the nation as Jacob, and then he speaks about it as Israel. Well, the basis for doing so is Genesis chapter 32, where Jacob, on the return from Padan Aram, after he had made the arch of his life, as it were, and returned to the brook where he was just to cross over the brook Jabbok. And he was met, of course, with the angel of God, who at first seemed to him as though it was a man. Verse 24, chapter 32. And he wrestled all night with him. And then when the angel wished to indicate his superior strength, he touched him upon the hollow of his thigh. And Jacob realized that he, in fact, was dealing with the might of God. And he said unto him, verse 27, what is thy name? Said the angel. What angel do you think that was, just by the way? If later Michael is spoken of as being the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, then it's very likely, isn't it, that this was in fact Michael, as here coming to give a name to that people that after this time he would care for. We don't know, but it's interesting that there was an angel who gave Israel its name. So he said, my name is Jacob, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, the supplanter, but Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. That's essentially what the word Israel means. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. But Jacob could never get the wrong idea of that, because when that name was given to him, he was in mortal grief, because he could hardly drag his leg along. It was smitten with such pain and agony that he knew that he was powerless, despite his brilliant mind and his tremendous zeal of life, to contrive and to do all sorts of things. And he learnt the power of God, the need to depend upon God. And as Hosea says, there he spoke to us. We learnt, the nation, a lesson from what happened to him here. But it was, wasn't it? God gave that man a name. He said, your name's Jacob, I'm changing it. I'm making it Israel. And that became the name of the nation. The man and his story were symbolic of a greater thing that God would do with many people. And just before we go back from there, I'd just like to stress the intimacy of that relationship, of that acquaintance that's exhibited in that 32nd chapter. In Genesis chapter 32 again, he actually asked the angel what his name was. Jacob was never too far behind, was he? He was an amazing person. What thy name is. I've told you what my name was when you asked and so on. Tell me what's your name. He's quite an amazing person. And he said, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face. Now that's a very intimate expression, isn't it? And my life is preserved. Later on it will be said of Moses. Moses is not like others, he said, mine acquaintance with whom I speak face to face. Well, he's another one. Peniel. So, isn't this on? Is that what you're saying? Sorry, I didn't turn it on, Greg. I thought you were making a bid there for a moment. Telling me that my tie wasn't straight or something. Must be on my mind, eh? All right. Chapter 43 of Isaiah again. That is the basis on which these remarks are found. And it's not surprising, therefore, that this chapter is going to reflect other incidents in the life of Jacob, just as that statement there does. It says, for I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. Again, notice the collection of statements in Isaiah 43. That are unique to that people. No other people has he ever said that of. But Israel, thou art mine, because I redeemed thee. And he paid a price, as it were, for that redemption. And you see, that said, despite verse 24 of chapter 42, thou art mine. But who gave Jacob for a spoil? And Israel to the robbers, did not I, Yahweh? And yet he is precious and loved of God. And all of those statements which occur in the rest of this remarkable chapter. Why did God love Israel? Why was there this particular affinity that he should have said, thou art mine? Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, he states the nature of that relationship. Did God love every particular Jew more than he loved every particular Gentile? It wasn't like that at all, was it? It wasn't because of the numbers of Israel or their righteousness. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 37, "And because he loved thy fathers, therefore he chose their seed after them, and brought thee out in his sight with his mighty power from Egypt." Because he loved thy fathers. That's why he will say in this very same chapter, in Isaiah 43 that is, "Therefore I have loved thee. Thou wast precious," verse 4, "in my sight. Thou hast been honourable. I have loved thee. Therefore I will give men for thee and people for thy life." It's an astonishing relationship, isn't it? So what he thought of Abraham and of Jacob was reflected in his love to their family and their children. You know, sometimes you feel like that yourselves, don't you? You have a friend, you're interested in his children. You love his children because you love your friend. Well, in a very real way, that is what is being said here. That because God loved Abraham, therefore he loved Jacob. And because he loved Jacob, he loved his children. Look at what they were. They were a mixed bag, to say the least, weren't they? And so there is a very real relationship between God and Israel because he loved their fathers. So chapter 43 and verse 2 says that, that being the case, "Because I have called thee by name, and thou art mine, and I have loved thee, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. Whatever circumstances come upon you, whether from one kind or another, whether it be cold and wet, or whether it be hot and of fire, yet I am with thee. When thou passest through the waters and through the rivers," what is plainly indicated is the history of the nation. Again, in verse 16 and 17, the same theme is picked up again. Verse 16, "Thus saith Yahweh, which maketh a way in the sea." That, of course, is the redemption from Egypt through the Red Sea. "And a path in the mighty waters, which bringeth forth the chariot of Pharaoh and his horse, the army and the power, all of the men that follow. They shall lie down together, but they shall not rise. They are extinct. They are quenched as tow." So, in this verse 2, the history of the exodus from Egypt is being brought forward as God's evidence of the fact that he has redeemed them, and that he will that he has called them by name, and that they are his. His redemption, verse 2, from the waters of the Red Sea and then the sea of the river of Jordan, is his testimony to that end. When he did that, he showed that he would indeed be with them. In Isaiah chapter 50 and verse 2, you have again the same echoes. The historical vibes are clear. 50 verse 2, "Wherefore, when I came, was there no man? When I called, was there none to answer? Is my hand shortened at all, that it cannot redeem? Or have I no power to deliver? Behold, at my rebuke, I dry up the sea. I make the rivers a wilderness. Their fish stinketh because there is no water, and dieth for thirst." Thus we have the description of what happened when they went through the Red Sea. And Isaiah a number of times will refer back to that incident. You see, that becomes to them almost like the grounds of their faith. Your faith, you will say, because the Lord Jesus Christ was crucified, and he was taken and buried, and he was risen from the grave. That's your conviction of faith, isn't it? On that you'll base your new life. Well, as far as Israel were concerned, coming out of the Red Sea, coming out of Egypt through the Red Sea, and all the things that happened, the 10 plagues and the opening of the sea, and then the blocking of the River Jordan, the turning, the reversing of its flow, they were the things on which that nation based its faith. And so God is saying, didn't I do that? Well, there's the evidence that I do, in fact, love thee, and that I formed thee and created thee, and thou art mine. But you see, look again at verse 2. It's really a statement of the future, isn't it? So what is it really saying? When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. It's not, whilst it has the echoes of the past, it's really speaking of the future. So what's that doing? It's saying, the certainty that I will be with you in the future is that I have proven my interest and love for you in the past. Those things become the touchstone of my future actions. Did I do this in vain? Did I do this lightly that I so delivered that people? Therefore will I let them down in the future to come? I will be with thee. And there's another little echo of the Jacob story. Come back, this time to the 28th of Genesis. This is a very, very important comment upon the life of Jacob. It's the statement that is carried on from one patriarch to the other. And it's very deliberate, this statement, I am with thee. Genesis chapter 28, this is Jacob and the ladder at Bethel. And amidst the promises, verses 13 to 15 that God gives, is this one in verse 15, behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. Now in verse 20, Jacob takes that part up. He's heard what God has said, and this is what he said. Jacob vowed a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way, that I go and will give me bread to eat, just the basics of life, then, verse 21, then shall Yahweh be my God. If he will go with me. You know, really in effect, that's everything, isn't it? If God is with you, what more do you need? If God is with you in your life, what more do you need? What else could you have than that? And so that becomes really the touchstone of Jacob's life, that phrase, I will be with thee. So that later on in Exodus 3, when there had been a long interruption of what we might call angelic visitation, in Exodus chapter 3, the same phrase comes out again. This is, of course, the time of the burning bush. And in chapter 3 and verse 12, God says this, certainly I will be with thee. And that was a key phrase. Not just an incidental phrase, it's a key phrase. And it showed, verse 6, that he was the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, to whom he made the same statement, I will be with thee. That's everything in life. So if he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then he will be with us, because that's what he promised Jacob. And Jacob took that up when God had, as it were, proven that in the cycle of his life when he came back to Bethel. He made an altar and declared, El Bethel. That is, this is the God of Bethel who has completed the circuit of my life and brought me back in peace to my father's place. So, you can see that it runs on from the man to the nation. True to Jacob, as it was to his forebears. True to Jacob, true to his people. Now in Deuteronomy chapter 31, the third of these occasions, Deuteronomy chapter 31, We've come out of Egypt and we're about to enter the promised land. So in Deuteronomy chapter 31 and verse 6, God says to Joshua, be strong and of a good courage. Or rather, Moses says to Joshua, be strong and of a good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of them, for Yahweh thy God, he it is that doth go with thee, and he will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. With Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob, with his people when they came out of Egypt, with his people when they go into the land. I will be with thee is therefore an historic statement related to the name of Jacob. And that's why so cleverly, so beautifully, so meaningfully it has been included in Isaiah 43 and verse 2. Now we understand about the waters and the rivers. What about the next bit then in verse 2? When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned. If the first part has this echo to the Red Sea and Jordan, what do you think the second bit is speaking about? Well, obviously the burning bush that we learned about at Sunday school. We learnt at Sunday school, didn't we? Exodus chapter 3 and verse 2, and the angel of Yahweh appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. There's no question about what that means, because if you go straight up the column, look at verse 23 and verse 24. It came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of bondage. And God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And he showed Moses the burning bush. So there is Israel, unconsumed in all of the tribulation and heat that was coming upon them in their persecutions in Egypt. You know, there's a couple of other very interesting references that confirm this sense later. In Jeremiah chapter 11. Could have gone back the other way, but anyway, we're in Jeremiah chapter 11. Speaks of the covenant, verse 4, which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt from the iron furnace. They weren't brought out of an iron furnace, were they? But the heat of that persecution was seen by the prophet as though it was an iron furnace. Now, say we could have gone back the other way, because that is actually a quotation. Got your little red pen out. In Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 20, Moses said this to them. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 20, but Yahweh hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt, to be unto him a people of inheritance, as ye are this day. Brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt. So it's not hard, therefore, to see that the prophets have already sketched the concept of what the fire and the burning is. There was a later example, wasn't there, in Daniel chapter 3, of one who actually did this. There was Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and they were in the midst of the furnace that Nebuchadnezzar had heated, and they were walking with the angel in the midst of the furnace. It was a little picture of really what happened to that nation as far as God was concerned. But again, verse 2, whilst those things are the basis on which verse 2 is founded, yet nevertheless this is a future statement. Now, my dear brothers and sisters, it's all very well to read that, but do you think what's happened to Israel? Do you think that they could read those words easily? 1900 years of Gentile furnace, despisements, and persecutions and afflictions,
They literally went into a furnace
to the tune of 6 million people. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. How do you work that one out? Neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. That means this verse 2 has got to be future, doesn't it? The amazing thing was that even as the flames were licking up that people in Europe, terrible thing, shocking thing, even as that was happening, there was a hardening of spirit and determination to stand up as a nation in the land of their fathers. In fact, it's probably true that if that had not happened, in all of the depth of it, Israel would still be wanting to be back there at the mess pots of the Gentile world. Tragic statement, but it's probably true, isn't it? They always have wanted that. In fact, I'm told even today, hard to believe, there's 100,000 Jews in Germany again today. Could you imagine that? It takes a long time for someone to learn a lesson. In verse 3, it says, "For I am Yahweh thy God, the Holy One of Israel, thy Saviour. I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Ethiopia and Seba for thee." In the earlier chapter, in chapter 40, it says in verse 17 that the nations are before him as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing. You know, we think of the nations in a very different way to what the Almighty does. He's saying, "I will give nations for thee." And he did. He did in their past, and that is an affirmative that he will do that in the future. The 10 plagues. The slaying of the firstborn of the last of those plagues. The destruction of the pride of Egypt in the Red Sea. Have a look again in Jeremiah chapter 44. And verse 30. "Thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will give Pharaoh Hophra, king of Egypt, into the hand of his enemies and into the hand of them that seek his life, as I gave Zedekiah king of Judah into the hand of Nebuchadrezzar king of Babylon, his enemy, and that sought his life." He's going to give a nation that he might allow, verse 28, a small number, however, to return to that land. He can use the nations and he can sell a nation that he might be able to achieve his purpose in another area. And so a remnant did return to Judah, as that 28th verse indicated. And later, you see, Cyrus would come down to Egypt again and punish Egypt. And he would do that so that that remnant might be released from the bowels of Egypt. Cambyses did the same thing. And Cyrus, of course, was the one who was going to give decree that the Jews could return to their land. And so he says, "I gave Egypt for thy ransom." And a number of times, Egypt did suffer at the hand of the men of the Babylonians, and then, of course, later at the hand of the Persians under Cyrus. Ethiopia and Seba, verse 3, they are, of course, related countries to Egypt. The Seba is in the area of the Arabian Peninsula, as we would call it, and Ethiopia is south of Egypt, and very often incorporated within the Egyptian hosts when they went forth in battle, because it was a related and subjugated people to Egypt. Verse 4, "Since thou wast precious in my sight, thou hast been honourable." And look at all the phrases. "Precious in my sight. Thou hast been honourable
and I have loved thee. Therefore I give men for thee and people for thy life. See, the nations are God's, as we saw in chapter 40, and therefore they're his possession. And he can do that if he so wishes. In chapter 41 and verse 8 and 9 we have something very similar. But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham my friend. That's the basis of his love. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, thou art my servant, I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Because of the depth of that friendship, he was therefore prepared to sell another nation, whether it be Egypt or whether it be later Babylon, or whether it be Cyrus again or the Persians again. He would do that because of his love for Israel. He would manipulate the affairs of that nation that Israel might be saved. Now, one or two most interesting things. Brother Thomas in Elvis Israel, pages 398 and 399, he used verse 3 to say, back in the 1850s, 1848 when he wrote the book, but subsequently he said it, that Britain would in fact take Egypt and Ethiopia. Britain had an interest in those areas at that time. Lord Kitchener was one of the people who led the British armies into that territory. So Britain had an interest. In 1882, for example, she occupied Egypt. Do you realise that? Britain occupied Egypt. And of course that gave her an interest in the land of Israel. Now that was after Dr. Thomas. He died in 1869. So, you know, that's after his time. But he did write as clearly as words could be that on the basis of this, Egypt would be given to Britain because Britain would help the Jews back to the land. That's what he said. And the areas of the peoples of those areas would be given into the hands of the British people so that they might be able to take that land and eventually give succor to the Jewish people to come back. Now, in actual fact, that happens. But when I look at that verse, I tremble to think of the confidence that he had to make that statement. And nobody's ever been able to really say why the doctor felt so convinced about that. Because the context doesn't seem to say that much, does it? It doesn't say that that's going to be Britain before Armageddon, but that's exactly what the doctor said, as clear as light. You go home and look at it, and Elvis is wrong. As clear as light. That's what it says. And what he said did in fact come to pass, and it was based upon this passage here. I just mentioned that as an interesting historical comment, because I don't think any of us could from the verse itself be able to say with such confidence if the facts were that they did in fact do exactly that. That's where Britain's interest in Palestine came. When World War One erupted, Britain was already in the neighbourhood. Did you notice again that it says in verse 5, fear not? It had said it in again, firstly in verse 1, fear not. It's in verse 10 again. No, it isn't. It's in verse 10 of chapter 41, that's what it is. Chapter 41 and verse 10, fear thou not. It's in verse 13 of chapter 41. Fear not, I will help thee. Verse 14, fear not, thou worm Jacob. Ye men of Israel, I will help thee. So we have it again here in chapter 43 and verse 5, fear not. And here's the Jacob phrase again, for I am with thee. A repetition of that key phrase. So, in verses 5 to 7, despite all that they might go through, whether it be, as it were, the afflictions of waters or of the fire of persecutions, fear not, for I am with thee. Now, that statement, as I said before, against the background of Israel's history, is really an amazing statement, isn't it? How would the Jewish people ever read that with their history? How do you and I read it? Haven't they been sore and terrible persecution? Weren't they stated before in Deuteronomy chapter 28? They really were. Clear as you like. And so this must be a statement, mustn't it, of Israel's future relationship with God despite all that has happened in the past. It's got to be. If it's not, then it means nothing. The chapter is ripped of all of its connections. It's got to mean that. How can people therefore turn to say that there is no future vindication of his people? And so therefore in the rest of verse 5 and 6, where he says that he'll bring them from the four corners of the earth, from the east, and gather them from the west, say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back, bring my sons from far and my daughters from the ends of the earth, even every one that is called by my name. That must be the children of Israel. There's no alternative to that understanding. There's a number of times in the prophet, I'll just show you one, Jeremiah chapter 30, where this four points of the compass return is spoken of. Just make there a note of Jeremiah 30 verse 10, but with time as it is, we'll look at Jeremiah 23. In Jeremiah 23 and verse 3, I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all countries whither I have driven them, and will bring them again to their folds, and they shall be fruitful and increase. In verse 8, but Yahweh liveth, which brought up and which led the seed of the house of Israel out of the north country and from all countries whither I had driven them, and they shall dwell in their own land. Now, those quotations are based upon Deuteronomy. If you come back quickly to Deuteronomy chapter 28, there are two significant verses here that are the basis of the dispersion, not just of the judgment of the Jews or the judgment upon Jerusalem, but in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 25, we have the first statement of the distribution of the Jewish people to all peoples. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 25. So this is an important verse. You know, the diaspora, here's where it comes from. Yahweh shall cause thee to be smitten before thine enemies. Thou shalt go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them, and shalt be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. And that word removed in the Septuagint is the word or the verb for diaspora. And so that's a very important verse. It's the first time, and remember, they're almost to be brought into there. They haven't got there yet. And God, before they've even got in there, says, I'm going to scatter you to all lands, removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. And again in the 64th verse, here's the second verse in this remarkable statement of Deuteronomy 28, the statement of Israel's history. Verse 28, verse 64, Yahweh shall scatter thee among all people, from the one end of the earth even unto the other. Now, in the 30th chapter, we have the reverse. Chapter 30, verse 1, it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations whither Yahweh thy God hath driven them, and shalt return unto Yahweh thy God, and shalt obey his voice. Then verse 3, Yahweh thy God will turn thy captivity, and you will return from all the nations whither Yahweh thy God hath scattered thee. Now that's the basis of Isaiah chapter 43. He said he would scatter them into all peoples, and he said he would return them to that land. If he's fulfilled the first part, we can be sure that he will fulfill the second. Ever thought just how remarkable it is that there is Jewish people in just so many places in the world? You can go to small country towns, even in Australia, you'll find that there's a small Jewish community even there. This is the most amazing thing. absolutely amazing thing that God has distributed them so much through the earth. So verses 5 and 6, therefore, are a wonderful reassurance that despite the dispersion, God has a plan for their bringing back to that land. And verse 7 amplifies the purpose. Even everyone, he says, that is called by my name, for I have created him for my glory. They're his, aren't they? Thou art mine, verse 1. They are precious, honourable, loved. People are given for thy life. For I have created him for my glory. I have formed him, yea, I have made him. He's not created that people just in vain, but that in other people, seeing the children of Israel, the children of Jacob, that they would be able to see that is the people of God, and I can see in them the hallmarks of character and purpose that God has. Now, you couldn't say that today. In many ways, could you? The character of the people is no different to the Gentiles. In many cases, they're in the front line of evil things. But you could see it in the way God has preserved them. Despite all that they have done, they're still there. So he sets them forth now as his witness. Bring forth the blind people, that is the Gentiles, verses 8 and 9. Here's a call to the nations to be converted by prophecy. By prophecy fulfilled. Bring forth the Gentiles. The blind people. Well, they've got eyes. And the deaf people. Yes, they've got ears. Well, bring them forth. Let's get down to this and let's have a conference about faith. And about the grounds of faith. Let all the nations be gathered together. Let the peoples, plural it is, let the peoples be assembled. So here's a call to all the nations. All got your various philosophies and ways of life. And your religion, your theocracies. All right, let's bring it all forward. Who among them can declare this? That is to say, who can state about the future what I will do with Israel? Or what will happen with the future of any people? Who can state it? Who among them can declare this and show us former things? Let them bring forth their witnesses that they may be justified. Or if they can't, then let them hear and say, it is truth. My word, my dear brothers and sisters, wouldn't you say that for all of our Sunday night and other gospel work? That if people would only see that what God has said, he has done, and once they see that, say, well, there's nothing else like it. There is no other book that has ever produced the evidence. You know, there are a lot of major, well-known books. We all hear of the Quran, for example, that the Muslims use. You know, you can search the Quran. It's a tripe of a book, if there be a red one. But you have a look at it. If you've got one at home, a heap of junk. You really wonder how that people could ever be moved by anything in it. It's just a lot of stupid stories. But anyway, there it is. There's not one element of prophecy in the whole thing. Not a stitch. Or you could get hold of the classics, for example, of Confucius. And see if there's something in there that speaks about the future and makes prophecy. It's silent. Or the Hindus with their Vedas. Not a single sentence about the future and what will be. And the Bible is full of it. Now I hope that, you know, sometimes we're criticized because we put prophecy up, don't we? We do. We put prophecy up and we say to people, for goodness sake, see what God has said and see what he's done and believe in him. That's the truth. And people sometimes say, we use prophecy all the time. Well, so we down will ought to. Because that's what Isaiah is doing. That's what God's doing. Let them all come up. I'll give them my proof. I said this, it happened. I said that, it happened too. Come on, where's your witnesses? So never be shy, my dear brothers and sisters, on that account. This message straightens our shoulders and helps us to see clearly what we should be doing. There's nothing wrong whatsoever in being able to point to people that God said this and he did it. Tell you what is a tragedy. When the two greatest books of all, as far as prophecy are concerned, Daniel and Revelation, are taken from our brotherhood with all the confirmation that they could give on exactly this point. That is a monumental tragedy. God declaring. He says, if you want to know that I exist and that this is the truth, I'll prove it by my word of prophecy. Where in all the world is there a voice of prophecy? Not a word, could you say. Who would ever think that 16 of the largest Japanese banks could possibly be bankrupt by the end of this year? Who could ever have imagined that? 6 months ago? 3 months ago? A day ago? You wouldn't have had a blue clue, would you? None of us would have. And that's how totally limited we are about the future. Who could ever have imagined 2 months ago that the US could be in the predicament it is? Great economic powerhouse to drive the world. And it was. It seemed to have its tentacles everywhere and everybody's looking to it. Today, it's got its president wringing his hands. And the world is looking for leadership to pull them out of this problem. And he's mired in all of his filth. Who could have declared that? Amazing things, my dear friends and sisters, aren't they? So that when God says, and he does it, don't have any lack of confidence. And no Daniel, and no Revelation. That's our glory, to know those things, isn't it? That we had books right from the start that told us those things. Have therefore faith and confidence in it. And love it, and know it, and teach your children that way. And young families, don't worry about all the other things. Get down to the readings at night. And as your children are growing up and becoming more and more aware of things, teach them those things. That they will be able to put their feet upon strong and clear paths. That they'll know what is right and they won't veer away from it. Because they've been able to prove those things, that what God said he has done. And therefore he's in control. Ye are my witnesses, verse 10, saith Yahweh. Ye are my witnesses. What did he mean when he said that? Did he mean that Israel will be the ones who could stand up and say, yes, God is right, Yahweh is right, because he said and it is done? Or did he mean, what happened to Israel proves the point? They're two different thoughts, aren't they? What do you think he meant? Did you see the two different points? Is he saying, Israel, you can testify because you know? Or is he saying, I set Israel forth as the evidence of my case? They're two different thoughts. What do you think? The second one. Yeah, I think you're right too. That's interesting, isn't it? You'll see that there's shades of both. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me. The unique and sole and omnipotent God, I, even I, am Yahweh. There's not another God in all the world. Big place, isn't it? But in all the world, in all the universe, there's not another God. There wasn't one before him. There won't be one after him. I, even I, am Yahweh. And beside me there is no Saviour. So he's not just a God of cold power or relentless purpose. But he's a Saviour. I've redeemed thee, he says in verse 1. He wants to say, loves his people, verse 4. I have declared, verse 12. I stated it and have saved. I said that I was going to do it. I said to Moses, this people will come and they will worship me at this mount. And they did. Despite Egypt, despite the plagues that came upon them, one upon the other until 10, they came out of that land through the Red Sea and they worshipped me in this mountain. I said it and it happened. You are my witnesses. I have declared and I have saved and have showed when there was no strange God among you. There was no competitor. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. Now if you think about that, you'll see that's really in both senses, isn't it? I think the second sense was the predominant one, but both senses are there? Because you see, only Israel had the statements, didn't they? Where were the statements? Well, put along in your margin there, Deuteronomy chapter 28. Because Deuteronomy chapter 28 just spelt the whole story out. It's an amazing chapter. First invasion, second invasion, and then the encapsulation of Jerusalem with the siege of the Romans, all there in Deuteronomy chapter 28. And if in the days of Isaiah, Isaiah could make that so boldly, how much more ought we to use that evidence today? I'd like to hear some ringing good lectures about the power of God shown in his dealings with Israel to cause people to see, as we did back in April, to cause people to see that there is a God of Israel who has said this and he's performed it. He's done that hundreds of times. How dare the Jehovah's Witness take this chapter to themselves? You just think what God must think of that, my dear brothers and sisters. Here is God trying to indicate his absolute confirmation. He's told them about robbers and thieves and all that. That'll come because of him, okay. But then he turns the chapter and he speaks to them in the most endearing and intimate way. And the Jehovah's Witness come along and rip the page out of the Bible and say, that applies to us, here we are. Pay up your money, you have your book from the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's not a laughing matter, is it? It's a mighty serious matter. They've just ripped it out of its context. Were they taken out of the Red Sea, taken from Egypt? Has that got anything to do with their history? Nonsense. How do they prove that God exists? There's 2,000, 3,000 years of the other people's life. 4,000 years almost. And God has spoken concerning that people. And he sets them forth to all the world as his witnesses. And this crowd come up in the last minute, rip it out of its context entirely and say, here we are. Pay for your books because we got the message. Now, it's a very serious thing, isn't it? So when you're speaking to Jehovah's Witness, have your arguments and reason with them from the scriptures. Not quite as strongly as I might to you, but reason with them, because the case must be put. That is God's desire, isn't it? Surely it is God's desire. He is not supine, as it were, to these issues. Now I think we will leave it at that point, because we've already touched on verses 16 and 17. And perhaps just finalise with verse 15, where God says, I am Yahweh, your Holy One, the Creator, back to verse 1, the Creator of Israel, your King. How beautiful those words are, my dear brothers and sisters. How thankful we are to know the truth and to be able to be confirmed in the knowledge of Israel's history. And may that continue with us and with our young ones, that they will always be able to make that case.